Okay, good morning, everybody. Today, this is Bio 241. And it's a Tuesday. What's the date today? March 3rd. Yeah, we're all on the same page. Let's get some of these lights down so we can see the slides. Like that. All right, so looking at the schedule, the third indeed it is. We're going to start cell respiration and metabolism. So a little bit more chemistry. This is like hardcore biochemistry, not so much physical chemistry or general chemistry we've been looking at, but all of that stuff will help you understand what we're going to be talking about here. And that is how our bodies use different molecules to provide energy for everything that our bodies do. All right, but we first got to finish up a couple of things with enzymes and energy, chapter 4. And that's what you see on the left-hand slide. Okay, so I'm going to finish, I want to recapitulate this slide a little bit. But in terms of the rest of the schedule, you have another test, exam 2, on March 24th. That's before spring break. And how many weeks away is that? Two, three, exactly 3 weeks away. And don't forget, 4, 5, 7, and 9 are going to be on that test. All right, so I understand some people will miss how many chapters are on that exam because they are talking. All right, so make sure that you're not disturbing anybody else that's around you, okay? Don't disturb anybody around you. Okay, any questions about the schedule? What's on exam number 2? And we're going to finish up 4 and move on to 5 today. All right, an enzyme. What the heck is an enzyme? What does an enzyme do? What does it do? Okay, that's how it does it, but I still want to know what it does. I like that. That's a really good answer. An enzyme speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. It cannot make a reaction happen that won't happen by itself, but it just speeds up the rate of a reaction that will proceed given enough time. A good example of that would be hydrogen peroxide breaking down into water and oxygen. Right, that hydrogen peroxide in a bottle that you have at home, if you wait 10 or 20 years, when you open it up, it will just be oxygen and water inside there. Right, but if we put an enzyme like catalase, all that hydrogen peroxide will be converted in mere seconds into water and oxygen. That's what the job of an enzyme is, just speeds up the rate. And then you should know why that is so. How is that possible, that it speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction? And a good way to say that is lowering the activation energy for that reaction to take place, and that's what is shown on this slide. All right, so that activation energy is represented by this barrier over here and over here, and you can see that this first column represents the non-catalyzed reaction, the second column is what happens when we put in an enzyme, and you can see that the energy barrier for the progress of that reaction is larger when there is no enzyme, and it becomes smaller when there is an enzyme present. Okay, and what else do we see on this? So the activation energy changes. What about the overall yield of energy for that reaction? Does it change? Energy released or consumed is exactly the same. So an enzyme doesn't change anything about the energetic. It just changes the amount of the activation energy. And the way you should think about that is that an enzyme has a surface that is able to put substrates together in the right way so that the pieces of those two substrates come together so that a proper reaction can take place. And it will always produce the proper products. All right, so that's what an enzyme does. And before products form, what has to form? Enzyme-substrate complex. Yeah. That's right. So if anything disturbs that enzyme-substrate complex, then you're going to inhibit the production of products. Right? You've changed the active site or somehow altered the enzyme, then that's going to change the rate of the reaction. Right? So enzymes change the activation energy, but do not change the energy released by the reaction. So here we have a reaction. Energy is being released. Right? Reactants have a higher energy compared to products. What kind of reaction is that? Is that in terms of energy, is it endergonic or exergonic? Exergonic, right? It's releasing energy, right? All right, so that's what I wanted to say about this particular slide. Anybody have a question with this slide here? You're doing pretty good with that? All right, well, here is that other exam figure that shows that enzyme-substrate complex formation, shows some nice active sites. right, and here's a one-way arrow. And the other important thing is that the enzyme is not altered when it catalyzes the reaction. So that means if the enzyme remains the same, it can catalyze the reaction over again and over again and over again. And that's another reason why the chemical reaction is sped up, because the catalyst is not destroyed, is not used up during the reaction process. Okay, we also talked about naming some enzymes. I think this is important, so we're going to go over this once again. I'm not showing you on the slide what it is, but there is a special kind of enzyme that will add a phosphate group to a molecule, like a protein, for instance. All right, what kind of enzyme will add a phosphate group? Usually it gets a phosphate from ATP. It will break down ATP and add that phosphate to another thing. What kind of enzyme is that? That is a kinase. Yep, that is a kinase. ASC, you know, is an enzyme. And that enzyme was named before modern nomenclature came into being. Okay? And what's antagonistic to a kinase? A phosphatase, right? And it can work on the same molecule. One will add a phosphate, one will take it off. That's a nice antagonistic mechanism. And what does a nice antagonistic mechanism provide in our body? What does it provide for? Okay. Precise control, that's right, precise control and balance, right, for that particular system. Just like the gas pedal and brake pedal, precise control and balance of your automobile, right? And when I say balance, I mean, say you're traveling at a certain speed, right, and you hit the accelerator, what's going to happen to your speed? It's going to go up. What happens if you hit the brake pedal? It's going to go down. The balance part is, what happens if you hit the brake pedal and the gas pedal equal amounts?
Nothing
is going to change. That's what I mean by balance. Okay? Balance means that if we add input to the positive side and the negative side equally, nothing is going to change. That's a pretty important concept. Okay. We looked at some optimal activities. Oh, here is something that's important. All right, coenzymes and cofactors. Remember, a cofactor is a small inorganic metal ion, right? And most of these are divalent cations. And a coenzyme is a huge organic type molecule. So there's going to be a huge difference. A cofactor, right, can influence enzyme activity because it will bind to the enzyme and change the conformation of that enzyme, making the active site a better fit for the substrates or a less better fit. So it could have a positive effect or an inhibitory effect of the enzyme, and it all depends on the particular enzyme. And the next slide shows where that cofactor can bind. It can bind to a site other than the active site, which we see right here on the top row. What kind of regulation is that? That is allosteric regulation. All right, a cofactor could bind within the active site. What kind of regulation is that? That is orthostatic, yeah, allosteric versus orthostatic. I don't think your book mentions orthostatic, but it mentions that process. Might as well have a good name for it, okay? Okay, so this cofactor is small. A coenzyme, on the other hand, is a very large organic molecule, and maybe I'm going to get to that slide next. Okay, metabolic pathways. We talked about metabolic pathways. Bioenergetics, yeah, we had fun talking about that. That was good. Okay. Okay, let's start with this slide right here. Okay, coupled reactions and ATP. And let's look at this. All right, so here is a chemical reaction. It's kind of laid out in a vertical format instead of a nice horizontal format. But this chemical reaction right here says adenosine diphosphate, right, that nucleotide with two phosphates, when it combines with another inorganic phosphate, it can become ATP, right? And so this bottom illustration is just what ATP looks like. Right, so and that ATP has high energy bonds between, well, here's the alpha phosphorus, here's the beta, here's the gamma. So between the alpha and beta phosphorus and between the beta and the gamma phosphorus, these are high energy bonds. So when these bonds are made, it requires a lot of energy. When these bonds are broken, it releases a lot of energy. That's what that little squiggly line right there means. Okay. Well, I want you to modify this diagram because when you have ADP and inorganic phosphate making ATP, I want you to definitely know if this is an endorganic or an exorganic reaction, going just as it's shown on this slide. Okay? All right, so some people said endorganic. I like that. So if it's endorganic, where would you put energy as a substrate? Is it a reactant or a product if it's endorganic? Yeah, it's a reactant, right? So go ahead and put plus what over here next to ADP and inorganic phosphate. You want to go plus energy. Yeah, so think of energy as a real kind of substance, right, that has to participate with this reaction. And then you get ATP. And then where did that energy go? Into ATP. That's right. So it's stored in a chemical form in these chemical bonds of ATP. Okay. And so if we go the reverse direction, if we take ATP and convert it into or hydrolyze it into ADP and inorganic phosphate, then is that exorganic or endorganic? That's an exorganic reaction, right? Because the products... one of the products is a release of energy. Okay, so let's get back to this figure right here, coupled reactions and ATP. So we saw, I guess I want to stay right on this slide a little bit. So we saw right here on this slide, in order to make ATP, we not only need ADP and inorganic phosphate, what else do we need? Energy. What kind of reaction can provide energy, will release energy? An exergonic reaction, right? So here, the production of ATP is endorganic. It can be coupled with other exergonic reactions, or it has to be coupled with other exergonic reactions to get that necessary energy to make ATP. And that's what we see on this slide right here. All right, so here is, for instance, an endorganic reaction. The reactants have less energy compared to the product, so we have to put energy into this chemical reaction to make it work, right? And here is the scale for free energy. As you move down the scale, energy decreases. As you move up in the direction of this arrow, energy increases. So for this particular small little wheel, right, the reactants are going to products, and you see that that is an endorganic reaction. What endorganic reaction were we just considering? Making ATP. So you could say making ATP with this big wheel right here. Right? Endorganic reaction, making ATP. And how can that happen in our body? That energy has to come from someplace. It comes from this other set of reactions, or you could think of it as just another reaction, where you have reactants at high energy, products at a low energy, that energy is released, and that's what we call an exorganic reaction. Okay? And that energy can be used to drive the one over here on the right, which is what? The production of ATP. So these are nice coupled reactions. All right, so that's why the book says, or these slides say, that most exorganic reactions, right, are used to make ATP. Because the production of ATP requires energy because it's an inorganic reaction. It has to come from someplace. It comes from other exorganic reactions. And we're going to talk about some of those reactions in the next chapter. So it's kind of strange the way you have to think about it, right? So most exorganic reactions in the body make ATP because, and that's strange because what is the nature of the reaction that makes ATP? It is an endorganic reaction, right? So you've got to like expand your view of this slide a little bit before it makes sense. Okay. Hopefully it doesn't sound like gobbledygook to you still, but if it does, see me during office hours. All right, so here is a nice ATP molecule. It is a large organic molecule, right? And it is carrying something from one reaction to another, and what it is carrying is energy. And as a matter of fact, it would be okay with me if you were to think of ATP as a coenzyme. What's the definition of a coenzyme? Is it a small metal ion or a large organic molecule? It's a large organic molecule, and what does that large organic molecule do if it is a coenzyme? It carries something from one chemical reaction to another chemical reaction, or from one set of chemical reactions to another set of chemical reactions, right? And so what is that thing that ATP is carrying from one set of chemical reactions to another? It is energy, right? So it's okay with me if you think of ATP as a coenzyme because of that. Okay, I have a couple of examples right here. They're really small to look at, but here are some other large organic molecules. And they're carrying something from one chemical reaction to another. And we have two of these compounds. We have nicotinamide dinucleotide, kind of reminds you of ATP a little bit, right? And then we've got flavin adenine dinucleotide over here, FAD. And these things are carrying high energy electrons from one set of chemical reactions to another. So when you look at NAD, and as a matter of fact, this is really nice if you see this right now, NAD has an electrical charge on it. Do you see that electrical charge? It's really small. It's positive. Your book likes to leave that off of a lot of its diagrams, but you should know that it's always there. NAD plus, and then FAD doesn't have an electrical charge. Right, these are carrying high energy electrons. So what is a large organic molecule that is carrying something, even electrons, from one reaction to another? These are coenzymes. Right, so NAD plus and FAD are coenzymes, and we're going to see how they participate in some reactions coming up pretty soon. Right? Can you see that these things are not cofactors? Not cofactors because they're huge. You don't have to remember the drawing of these things like I wanted you to remember what a phospholipid looked like. Okay, just know that NAD plus and FAD are these huge organic molecules, and they're carrying high energy electrons. Well, there's a whole, and I'm going back to the previous slide. So there's a whole class of reactions that we call oxidation reduction reactions. Some of you in chemistry have looked at these before, and it can be a little confusing, but I want you to always think about the basic, simplest definition for what a reduction reaction is and what an oxidation reaction is. All right, so if a molecule gains an electron, it receives an electron from some other place, right? Then we say it is reduced. All right, but if a molecule loses an electron, it becomes oxidized. Okay, so losing electrons, oxidation, gaining electrons, reduction. Right? So the thing that probably you recognize right now is that you cannot have an oxidation reaction happening by itself, right? It is always paired up with a reduction reaction, right? Or so for instance, if a molecule gains an electron, it becomes reduced, but where does it get that electron from? Some other molecule, and when that molecule gives away that electron, it becomes oxidized, right? So these are always paired reactions, and thus we call these oxidation reduction reactions. All right, so when a molecule gains an electron, okay, we say it's reduced. So a reducing agent donates electrons. All right, and if there's an oxidation reduction reaction happening with a reducing agent, what happens to the reducing agent? It becomes oxidized. Maybe write that down in parentheses or something. Okay, the reducing agent becomes oxidized because what does that reducing agent do? It reduces something else by giving away electrons to it, right? An oxidizing agent accepts electrons, right? So what happens to this oxidizing agent? It becomes reduced because it does what? It accepts electrons from somebody else. All right, so these are always coupled reactions. They involve, now your book makes a big deal of these hydrogen ions, not really written out, but that's like a hydrogen without electrons around it. And so you could call that a proton. And your book likes to focus on protons, but I like to focus on electrons. So I'm going to talk about transfer of electrons and not protons, which is a little bit different than your book, but I think it makes more sense.
The difference between the way a chemist would look at it versus a biologist?
I'm not sure why there's that deviation there. Because, and it's... maybe I have a little bit of an archaic view. It was never described as a transfer of protons when I was going through school. Okay, so somehow I missed the boat on why it evolved that way. All right, so coenzymes, right, like NAD. Oh, what should you have here with NAD? A plus, right, NAD plus and FAD. These are coenzymes that play important roles as what kind of carriers?
Electrons.
Just say electrons, because in the next chapter we're going to get into something called the electron transport chain. And I want you to focus on electrons and not necessarily these protons. And it just so happens that NAD plus and FAD are also vitamins. right? You heard of like niacin, nicotin, amides, and these big nasty organic molecules you cannot synthesize, or humans can't synthesize these things by themselves anymore, right? They need precursors or vitamins to make these kinds of things. All right, so here we see that NAD plus is going to accept two electrons, right? And those two electrons are going to go into this ring structure, right? And I see these two electrons right over here, so NAD, right? And two hydrogens, so one hydrogen and two electrons that's going to neutralize this particle right here. So this is just going to turn into NADH. So NAD plus turns into NADH, and that NADH is carrying two high-energy electrons. So that's why this is a coenzyme, right? FAD will accept two electrons and two protons. So two electrons and two protons exactly neutralize each other. So FAD just is converted into FADH2. All right, so NAD plus converted into NADH, and FAD is converted into FADH2. And I think I would like for you to know which is the oxidized state and which is the reduced state. So what is the reduced state of something? How do you reduce something? Give it in electrons, okay? Yeah, so here we have NAD. It's going to receive electrons, all right? So NAD plus, since it's going to receive electrons, is the oxidized form. After it receives those two electrons, it becomes the reduced form, right? So NADH is the reduced form. It's carrying high energy electrons. Same thing for FAD and FADH2. FAD is going to accept high energy electrons, right? So FAD is the oxidized form. After it accepts those electrons, it becomes the reduced form, right? And as a matter of fact, when FAD is reduced into FADH2, what else has to happen with some other molecule, right? If FAD becomes reduced, what else has to happen? Something else has to be oxidized, right? Something else has to be oxidized, all right? And hence, that is what we consider an oxidation-reduction reaction, okay? And there's a couple little sayings that people use in chemistry to remember which way this thing goes, and one is Liouville, like Liou is a name. Lose electrons, oxidation, GER, gain electrons, reduction. And I think there's another couple, oil rig. What does oil rig mean? What does oil stand for?
Oxidation, losing electrons.
Oil, oxidation, losing electrons, OLE.
Reduced
and
gaining.
Rig. Okay, reduced.
Is gaining.
Is gaining.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so okay, it does make sense. You might have to write it out on a piece of paper first to see that. Okay, so if you can't remember this basic definition, you only have to remember one of these, right? When a molecule gains an electron, it becomes reduced. Because when it goes the other way, right, then it becomes oxidized. Okay. All right, so again, we're very important in terms of this electrical charge running around inside of our body. All right, so that's it for this chapter. Anybody got a question on this one? Okay, how about a really tough question? What happens to entropy? What happens when my battery completely dies? Well, what color is that? Red. Red is not a good sign, right? Okay. My question was, what happens to entropy? Does it increase or decrease when a system becomes less organized, becomes more random? When a system becomes disorganized, what happens to entropy? Entropy increases, right? That's kind of a funny concept, right? So entropy increases a lot of times when reactions happen spontaneously. Okay, like this little demonstration that we had on the table last time. Okay, let's see, battery packs. I got some battery packs right here. All right. Anybody got a question on that? That was the other maybe tough concept. Okay. So what's the next chapter that we're going to go to?
Chapter 5.
Let's see what we got. We're going to end the show. What's going to happen if I just turn the transmitter back on without muting it? You might want to hold your ears. I don't know if there's going to be a strange thing happening. Or not. Oh, it didn't because the power went. I have to turn it back on. Okay, so I'm turning it back on. Hold your ears. Ah, oh, how gentle was that? That was nice. Okay, so moving on to the next chapter. Unless somebody has a question, I don't see questions. Good. All right, so make sure that you understand the difference between a cofactor and a coenzyme. Which one's bigger?
Coenzyme.
Okay, is an enzyme by itself big or small?
Big.
It's big, right? So that helps help you understand why one is called a coenzyme. Okay, but it doesn't tell you what the function necessarily is. Okay, so here we go. Cellular respiration and metabolism. Let's move this up so I can see slide mode. That's chapter 5. We're going to look at things like glycolysis, aerobic respiration, a little bit of fat and protein metabolism. All right, so let's define a couple things first. Metabolism. All right, metabolism is just the sum of all the chemical reactions that are taking place in your body. All of the exergonic reactions, all of the endergonic reactions, all lumped together, right? And that builds in a chemical set, right, all the living processes that are taking place. Furthermore, metabolism, I got to get my cursor back. Furthermore, metabolism can be broken down into two categories. Right, reactions that release energy and those that require energy. Right, and so one we call catabolism. Catabolism breaks down large molecule and releases energy. So these are exorganic reactions. And how do large molecules typically get broken down into smaller ones? What kind of reaction?
Hydrolysis.
Yeah, nice hydrolysis reaction. Right, so there's that fancy solvent molecule, water, participating in these reactions. And we said that exergonic reactions are the primary source of energy for making ATP, because ATP is endergonic. It's got to get energy from someplace. Anabolic reactions, on the other hand, make larger molecules from smaller ones and requires energy. Like, for instance, making a nucleic acid like DNA from nucleotides. Okay? A protein synthesis would be another example of putting amino acids together, would be anabolism. And to do that, right, it's going to require energy. Okay. So anytime you take building blocks to make a polymer, right, that is anabolism. If you take a big polymer and break it down into its building blocks, that is catabolism. Okay, so here is a really important slide. Certainly the most important slide, I think, for you to take away from the class. And what is interesting about this slide, because it contains some very important information, but it's not on this slide. So I want you to figure out what is the most important thing about this slide, but you can't probably tell me today. Maybe you could tell me today, but sooner or later, by the end of this week, I want you to be able to tell me what's missing from this slide, which is the most important consideration. Well, let's look at what do we see on this slide. I see different rows of information. Probably you see some really nice colors. Like here's the top row that has the intestines and the liver. And then we have another row that represents the vascular system. Then we have another row that represents everything that's happening in the cytoplasm or the cytosol. Probably cytosol is a better way of talking about this. So this is inside of a cell, but not inside of an organelle. And then our last row right here represents chemical reactions that take place only in mitochondria, right? So here we have the spaces of your digestive tract, then we have your vascular system, then we have inside of cells but not in an organelle, and then we have things that are happening inside of mitochondria. So it would be really good if you knew where all these things are taking place. All right, so these are the rows. I also see two columns. I see the intestines over here on the left, and I see liver on the right. Well, both of these, well, organ system and organ can help regulate, what do you see in the blood vessel right here? Help regulate glucose levels in the blood. And you all have a sense how important glucose levels are in the blood, because if you can't regulate that, what disease would a person have? Yeah, diabetes mellitus, right? So that's a terrible disease. And so you can see that the digestive tract and the liver work to maintain blood glucose within a normal range to support life. All right, so how is that possible? Well, when we eat something, then there is plenty of glucose in our digestive tract that gets absorbed and put into our bloodstream, right? So when you're in a state where you are digesting food and glucose is entering the bloodstream, we call that the fed state, F-E-D, right? As opposed to this other state that I see over here, right? This is in a fasting state. I don't know if your book uses that terminology, but that's the proper terminology. Fed versus fasting. All right, so what organ is working when you're in the fasted state to help maintain blood glucose levels? Yeah, I see liver. Now, why is that? Because in the liver, you have a big, huge polymer of glucose, and that is called glycogen, right? That's just an animal starch. Okay, so when you're in a fasted state, blood glucose levels start to drop. There are signals that are sent to the liver to say, hey, break down glycogen and then secrete that glucose into the blood to help raise blood glucose levels. We're going to be interested in a couple hormones that do that. We've mentioned them previously, glucagon and insulin. And you could probably now just take a guess. What's the relationship between insulin and glucagon? They're antagonistic to each other, right? Because this is a very important mechanism. All right, so you got two states, fed and fasted. And depending on what state you're in, or maybe some combination, glucose is going to be entering the blood. And glucose then will leave the blood, will diffuse out into a cell. Glucose is going to be chopped in half. How many carbons are in glucose?
Six.
Yeah, there are six, right? And through a process that we call glycolysis, then that glucose is chopped into two pyruvic acid molecules, and if glucose is chopped exactly in half, how many carbon atoms are in a pyruvic acid? There are three, yeah. So pyruvic acid and pyruvate are exactly the same chemicals. Pyruvate, pyruvic acid, the same, right? Same thing for lactic acid. Lactic acid and lactate are the same. And I'll probably use those interchangeably, so don't get lost. When I say lactate or lactic acid, it means exactly the same thing. Okay, so glucose will make two pyruvic acids. And pyruvic acid has two different fates. It can enter the mitochondria, or it can be metabolized into lactic acid. Okay? If pyruvic acid is metabolized into lactic acid, where does that take place? In the cytosol. Yeah, you know, you should probably just write that down. Really big. Cytosol and mitochondria. It kind of implies that on the slide, but go ahead and write that down. I think that would be easier to see. All right. Well, pyruvic acid can be broken or can be converted into lactic acid in the cytosol under certain conditions, and that is under the conditions where oxygen is in a low concentration. When oxygen is in a low concentration, we call that anaerobic respiration. Anaerobic means without oxygen. And so this can happen, for instance, in skeletal muscle very nicely. Because when we use skeletal muscle very rapidly, when we contract a skeletal muscle, right, blood can't get into that skeletal muscle because it just becomes a big solid mass, and no oxygen is going in. That produces what? An anaerobic condition inside of those cells. And that's when lactic acid is produced. Right? And lactic acid produces discomfort and pain as well. Okay. Well, the other fate for pyruvic acid, if oxygen is available, pyruvic acid can enter what organelle? The mitochondria. That's right. And there are another set of chemical reactions inside the mitochondria. One is called Krebs cycle. Before the Krebs cycle, there's this little tiny arrow right there. And we're going to call that a preparatory reaction. All right, so here is an important step. Preparatory reaction. This little tiny arrow. Then we have this thing that looks like a wheel. That's the Krebs cycle. And then our last set of reactions is what we call electron transport. Okay, well here is, right, there's something in Krebs cycle that's being generated and it's being carried into the electron transport system over here. What do we call something that carries something from one set of chemical reactions to another? Coenzyme. What coenzymes have you bumped into already? NAD plus an FAD, right? Or NADH and FADH2. And indeed, so that's what's participating with this arrow right here, right? Because you know them to carry electrons, they get carried into the electron transport chain. And under what conditions does that take place and only under these conditions. Under high oxygen, we call that aerobic conditions, right? So what about Krebs cycle? Is that anaerobic or aerobic?
Aerobic.
Aerobic. Krebs cycles here in the mitochondria. What about electron transport? Aerobic or anaerobic?
Aerobic.
What about this preparatory reaction?
Aerobic.
What about lactic acid production? Anaerobic. Okay. Well, when these electrons are donated to the electron transport chain, these electrons combine with water and some protons. Oh, no, I'm sorry. These electrons combine with oxygen, right? This is why this is dependent on oxygen. These electrons combine with oxygen and some protons. And what do you get when you put two protons and an oxygen together? You get water. So the last thing that's produced is water, which is that really fancy solvent molecule again, right? And the carbon atoms that you told me glucose has, which is 6, right, end up in carbon dioxide. So all of the carbons in glucose turn into this little gas molecule, carbon dioxide, and those electrons end up in water. If those electrons don't have any place to go, and they go into oxygen, right, so if there's no oxygen, electrons have no place to go, this whole process stops. The preparatory reaction stops, Krebs cycle stops, electron transport stops. Yes, let me see if I can remember. Okay, here we have the preparatory reaction, Krebs cycle, and electron transport work because electrons will move through these different chemical reactions, especially this electron transport chain. If those electrons have no place to go, for instance, they go into oxygen. If there's no oxygen there for those electrons to go into, then all of these processes stop. Okay? So those electrons have to go someplace, and after those electrons combine with oxygen, what are you left with?
Water.
Okay? So that's where this oxygen comes from. So in order for everything inside of a mitochondria to proceed, what do you have to do in terms of breathing? You have to breathe in. Okay? You got to bring in oxygen to your body, distribute it to these mitochondria. Now, why is it that you have to breathe out? Okay? You have to get rid of CO2. That's right. So somebody could say, well, you have to breathe out so you can breathe in. That's just true, right? If you can only breathe in, that doesn't do you any good. Yeah, that happens, unfortunately, clinically to some people. It's uncomfortable when that happens, but I would want you to realize that you breathe in to get oxygen so that these mitochondria can operate aerobically. You breathe out to get rid of this byproduct, CO2. All right, so where is the CO2 produced? It's produced in the Krebs cycle, right, and also one in the preparatory reaction. So maybe just kind of jot that down. One CO2 comes out from this preparatory reaction, two CO2s come out from the Krebs cycle, and that kind of describes this figure pretty well. Everything that we talk about in the chapter, I want you to be able to relate to this diagram. So this is just an overview of everything that we're going to look at. And it'll be really good. And I think maybe next week in lab, I'm going to have you draw this out, and I'll give you the exact figure with my modifications on it as an extra credit drawing. Okay? Yeah, so next week. Is next week a holiday? No. All right, so there's a Tuesday and Thursday. All right, huh? You already went over this in lab?
Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good. I don't mind if your lab instructors did that because this is really important. Okay. Did you do a drawing already?
No,
you didn't do the drawing. Okay.
Oh,
so the extra credit is I'm going to send you this figure with a couple of my modifications on it, and if you can draw that from memory on a blank piece of paper, that will be worth one extra credit point next week. In lab, after lab. I like for students to have the opportunity to do it after lab, for instance. Some lab instructors maybe have you do it beforehand, but after lab is over, it's probably maybe a little bit better. Okay, so here you see a bunch of chemical reactions. Right, so what's the important thing about this diagram right here? If you know, don't say it out loud, because I want people to kind of think about it, dig it out themselves. All right, so I see CO2 is being produced. Okay, is that the important focus of this whole illustration right here? For the production, Right, is this metabolism for the production of CO2?
No.
No, that's nice. Is it for the production of water? Because we can't live without water. Is that why all these chemical reactions are there?
No.
Okay. All right, well, what else is that? Well, we said oxygen is being used up. Is that the whole point of this thing? We're trying to use up oxygen?
No.
That would be another example. What else? What about the production of lactic acid?
No.
Is that really the purpose of this illustration?
No.
No. Okay, and as I mentioned, the purpose of all of these chemical reactions right here is not even drawn on the slide, and next time I'll tell you. I want you at least to think about it a little bit over the week if you don't know. Maybe everybody knows. We don't even need to go over this chapter very much. Okay. All right, but everything, like I said, everything that we talk about in this chapter relate to this diagram. All right, so guess what we want to do first? We want to talk about this conversion of glucose to pyruvic acid. And where does that happen? Cytosol. Under what kind of conditions?
Low oxygen.
It can happen under low oxygen, and you know what? It can even happen under aerobic. So glycolysis really doesn't matter if it's aerobic or anaerobic. Only the step from pyruvic acid to lactic acid, right, happens under anaerobic conditions. And under anaerobic condition, nothing inside the mitochondria can happen. But glycolysis can go either way. Okay. When you look at glycolysis, the function of this metabolic pathway is used to name this pathway. What does glycolysis mean? What does lysis mean? Lysis just means blowing something up, right? Splitting something in half, like when you lyse a cell, you blow a cell up. And this glyco represents glucose, so glycolysis is what? The splitting of glucose. So the definition is right there. All right, look, here's glycolysis, the splitting of glucose. And you're going to split it in half. Okay, so it's a metabolic pathway where glucose is converted into two pyruvates, right? There's six carbons in glucose, three in pyruvates. I think that will be important for you to know. It does not require oxygen because where does it happen? Cytosol, right? Where does aerobic respiration take place? Mitochondria, right? So compartmentalize it like that. The overall net reaction for glycolysis is the input is glucose. A couple other inputs are NAD, and what should be on this little figure right here? A plus, right? 2 NAD+, right? 2 ADP plus 2 inorganic phosphates going to, well, we're going to split this glucose in half, right? Some of that energy in those bonds is going to be released, and NAD+ is going to be converted into 2 NADH and 2 ATP. Okay, so the production of ATP from ADP and inorganic phosphate, right, the production of ATP from what I'm kind of circling right now, is that endergonic or exergonic? That's endergonic, right? Okay, the splitting of glucose into 2-pyruvate has to be exergonic, right? Because this energy to make ATP has to come from someplace. So some of the energy is captured in that high energy phosphate bond, but also this NADH right here, I told you, is carrying 2 high energy electrons. And where does that energy come from? That energy in glucose. Okay, so NAD plus going to NADH, right, that's an oxidation reduction reaction, but it is also, you could think of it as an endergonic reaction that requires glycolysis, the splitting of glucose, to make it happen. All right, so glucose, the 2-pyruvates, is highly exergonic. Overall reaction. Okay. Glycolysis is exergonic. Produces 2 ATP. You can memorize that, right? And 2 NADHs, that wouldn't be a bad thing to memorize, but if you just have a sense, probably if you're going to develop a sense for that to be true, that would be just as good. All right. But here is a chemical reaction, right? Glucose going to 2-pyruvates. Like most chemical reactions, there is an energy barrier. And what has to be given to these set of reactions to overcome that energy barrier? Activation energy, right? So there is an activation energy that's required by glycolysis. That energy comes from ATP. In order for glycolysis to take place, glucose must be activated by 2 ATPs. So that's going to cost some energy, right? So glucose is phosphorylated. And then when glucose is phosphorylated, then it can go ahead and be split into two pyruvates. And that's going to release enough energy to pay back these two ATP that were needed to get the reaction started, just like any activation energy. Plus, an additional two ATPs are going to be produced, and then some NADHs are going to be produced as well. So here is a nice energy diagram of glycolysis. Right, so as a molecule moves up in the vertical scale, it has a higher free energy. As molecules move down, right, it has a lower free energy. So here we have glucose going up to step number one up here. Actually, there's two steps. You don't have to know the name of this molecule. But glucose going to this number one, is that exergonic or endergonic? Okay. Going from glucose, which is at this level, to number one right here, which is at a higher level. Okay. Glucose from low to whatever it is here, high energy, that is an endergonic reaction. Okay. And remember, that was that activation energy barrier on that first diagram that we looked at. Where did that energy come from? The hydrolysis of ATP to ADP, and it requires two of them. All right, so what can you tell me about the reaction of ATP going to ADP? Is that endergonic or exergonic? It's exergonic, right? So ATP is being hydrolyzed. It's an exergonic reaction. That energy is used to get glucose over this energy barrier so that glycolysis can proceed. All right, so ATP to ADP is exergonic. Glucose to this high step is endergonic. It's receiving that energy from ATP. And once that molecule, which glucose with two phosphates on it, right, has so much energy that it can be split all the way down to pyruvic acid through a number of chemical steps. What do we call something that has a number of enzymatic steps in it? And there are chemicals in these different steps that we call intermediates. What do we call this pathway right here? Metabolic pathway, right? Because it contains many enzymatic steps. Okay, in one of the steps, NAD plus, actually two NAD pluses will produce two NADHs. What's happening in this NADH right here? Okay, it is a reduced form of NAD, so what is it carrying? And remember, it's a coenzyme. What is it carrying? I want you to think of those as high energy electrons, right? So NADH is carrying energy in the form of those electrons, right? And so what kind of reaction is this? NAD going to NAD plus going to NADH. Just look at this, look at the scale over here. What has more energy, NADH or NAD plus? NADH has more energy. So what kind of reaction is this? This is endergonic, right? Endergonic because the product has more energy than the reactants. Where did that energy come from? The conversion of whatever this thing at step number one is to step number two. I'm not going to have you remember what these chemicals are. Right, but from one to two is exergonic. That energy is used to make NADH, right? NAD plus going to NADH is endergonic. It gets the energy from this glycolysis metabolic pathway. We got a couple more steps. All right, so from two to three, we have ADP and two of these, two ADPs and two inorganic phosphates making two ATP. What kind of reaction is ADP going to ATP called? Endergonic, right, because the products have more energy than the reactants. How is that possible? Because it's coupled with another reaction that is exergonic, right? 2 to 3 is releasing energy. That's an exergonic reaction. All right, so here's 2 ATP. How many ATPs were necessary to get glycolysis started? Exactly 2. So now we're exactly even in terms of energy produced or released from glycolysis, right? Those 2 ATP were paid back. And then in this last step over here, we see 2 ATPs are produced. Right, and again, this is an endergonic reaction. It's driven by the exergonic reaction of this metabolite number 3 to pyruvic acid on this slide. That energy goes into ATP. So the net reaction for glycolysis is how many ATPs are produced? Okay, are 2, because it takes 2 to get it started. The first 2 then pay back the two for the activation energy, you're left with just an overall two ATPs for glycolysis. But another important thing you should remember is what? Those high energy electrons carried by NADH. Okay. We don't want to lose that energy either. So glycolysis can produce some ATP. Now, how important is that ATP?
Very
important. Cut off ATP from the brain, like if you stop oxidative or aerobic respiration in the brain, how many seconds of consciousness do you have? Mere seconds, right? That's how important ATP is. So glycolysis, right, can produce 2 ATP to help us maintain consciousness. All right, so here is the exam figure for glycolysis. All right, so here we have glucose, 6 carbons. It's got to be phosphorylated twice, right? So it becomes 1,6-biphosphate. So there are 2 phosphates on here. Then it is split into these compounds. There's some molecular rearrangements with an oxidation reaction, reduction reaction with NAD plus going to NAD, right? So you get 2 of those. Then you get 4 other steps where an ATP is produced. These first 2 pay back the ATP that were used up initially. And then on this last step over here, right, then you make 2 ATP, okay? And you end up with pyruvic acid. Okay, I was kidding you when I said this was an exam figure. It is not this semester, all right? But I do want you to know some important things, okay? All right, so you don't have to know all these chemical what do you call these different chemicals along the way? I told you, unfortunately, right? They're intermediates, all right? So you can see there are a number of enzymatic steps. Now, when you look at this diagram, what kind of reaction is this? Is this a one-way or a two-way reaction? Yeah, you see arrows that are going down. We're going to call that the forward reaction. Forward reaction when glucose is broken down to pyruvic acid. That's going to release energy. Pyruvic acid can also be combined with itself. If we take 2 pyruvic acid under the right circumstances, it can be used to make glucose. All right, so glycolysis is glucose to pyruvic acid. Pyruvic acid back to glucose is what we call gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis, the building of new glucose in your body. Okay? So, people that have trouble regulating blood glucose levels, part of the problem might be that they're eating too much glucose, right? There's too much glucose in their diet. Another problem might be maybe their glucose intake is normal, but maybe this pathway right here is overactive. Maybe their own body is making too much glucose. Maybe gluconeogenesis is too much of an important metabolic pathway in their body. All right, so there's 2 possible reasons for diabetes mellitus. Yeah.
You were saying when you go from pyruvate to
glucose, I better write this down. Right? Gluco and then neo, which means new, and then genesis means making. Genesis. All right. Okay, so what's the opposite of gluconeogenesis? Glycolysis. Glycolysis is the opposite. Okay? And so that's, I think, something really important. Okay? Well, when gluconeogenesis is taking place, what about ATP production? This reaction has to go backwards too. Yeah. So under the conditions of gluconeogenesis, that's going to require ATP. It's going to use up ATP as a result of that. Okay. So only under certain circumstances would that happen. What about NADH? When, yeah, it goes back to NAD+. All right.
So do you end up having a deficit?
Yeah.
ATP?
Yep. So under circumstances where your body is operating under a high energy, high ATP, gluconeogenesis can take place pretty easily. Right? So that energy then is going to be stored in the form of glucose. And of course, glucose then can go to the liver, be stored in glycogen, for instance, when ATP is really high.
So they also require ATP when they want to go back to the...
Yes, gluconeogenesis requires ATP. What else does it require? It requires NADH. Right? Just like it requires ATP, gluconeogenesis requires NADH. So here is another point, since we've kind of talked around this all the time. In order for glycolysis to go in the forward direction, and we like that reaction because it produces ATP for us, so we know how important that is, okay? What will happen if all of our NAD is in a reduced form, is in an NADH form? What happens to glycolysis when you don't have NAD plus, you only have NADH available? It stops. Can you see that? In order for glycolysis to proceed, what do you need? You need NAD plus to be converted into NADH. If you only have NADH, that will inhibit glycolysis. When glycolysis is inhibited, what happens to ATP production?
It
stops. And you know that is a bad circumstance, right? Okay, so we're very interested in this NAD plus and NADH for that reason as well. Which takes us to this slide, the lactic acid pathway. Can you remember where this was in that initial slide?
Pyruvate.
Yeah, right here, cytosol. So here is pyruvic acid. Right, it gets converted into lactic acid under anaerobic conditions. Why is that? The reason is because we don't want to shut down glycolysis, because what is glycolysis producing for us? ATP, right? So if pyruvic acid builds up under anaerobic conditions because it can't get into the mitochondria, what else is building up besides pyruvic acid? Okay. The other thing that's building up is NADH, and NAD plus is going away. As NAD plus goes away, then glycolysis stops and it doesn't produce ATP. So under anaerobic conditions, what happens is that NADH is converted back to NAD plus. And when the cytosol has NAD plus, what happens to glycolysis? It can start to go back to the forward reaction, right? So this anaerobic respiration step, sometimes we call this a fermentation step, when pyruvic acid is converted into lactic acid, right? When that happens, NAD plus is produced. And why do you need NAD plus? To make NADH during glycolysis, right? So that anaerobic pathway is just a way to maintain glycolysis under what kind of conditions? Anaerobic conditions. Because if this pyruvic acid built up inside the cell and NADH built up inside the cell, that would stop glycolysis, and then the cell couldn't produce any ATP. That's a terrible circumstance when that happens. All right, so that's the importance of the lactic acid pathway. What does it do? It regenerates NAD+, and it also gets rid of pyruvic acid. You remember Le Chatelier's principle? Right. Le Chatelier principle says that as a compound builds up on one side of the reaction, it forces the reaction to go in the reverse. So when pyruvic acid builds up inside the cell, that's going to promote what? The reverse of glycolysis, which is gluconeogenesis, which doesn't produce ATP. As a matter of fact, what does it do to ATP? It even uses it up. Right? So that's the importance of that lactic acid pathway. Right, it regenerates NAD+, so glycolysis can happen in the forward direction, and it also gets rid of pyruvic acid, so it doesn't inhibit glycolysis or this reaction going in the forward reaction. Right, so that's the importance of this lactic acid pathway. All right, so in the absence of oxygen, NADH gives its electrons to pyruvate. All right, so here is a nice oxidation reduction reaction. Let's take a look at this. So what form is NADH, oxidized or reduced? Okay, NADH, what is it carrying? It's carrying high energy electrons, which means then NADH is, since it's carrying these electrons, it is in the reduced form. All right, so just maybe jot that down, NADH reduced form. All right, and NAD plus then has to be in the oxidized form. Right, so these electrons in NADH were given away to somebody, making an oxidized NAD+. All right, well, what about pyruvic acid? Is that reduced or oxidized? Wow, you guys are going to have to help me with this because I'm talking and thinking at the same time. It's tough. All right, we said NADH is reduced, a reduced form, and so pyruvic acid is the oxidized form because it's going to accept these electrons from NADH. So lactic acid is the reduced form. All right, so we got this first, think of this as this first column over here, NADH, right, as being reduced, which means pyruvic acid is oxidized. Then in the second column over here, NAD plus is oxidized, which means that lactic acid is the reduced form. Yeah. So hopefully on the slide it says someplace about oxidation reduction. I don't see it. Okay. All right, this pyruvic acid cannot leave the cell. It's trapped inside the cell, but lactic acid can leave the cell, right? And so that just promotes glycolysis going in that forward direction, and it also regenerates that NAD+. All right, and what's the name of this enzyme?
LDH.
Yep, LDH, lactic acid dehydrogenase, right? And there's a ASC on the end. You could just call it the LDH reaction. Okay, so a good question, a good synopsis would be, what's the purpose of the LDH reaction? It produces lactic acid, yeah? But there's some things that go along with that. What does that do? Keeps glycolysis working in the forward reaction because it regenerates NAD+, yeah? And it regenerates NAD, and it gets rid of pyruvic acid. All right, and why is that NAD plus necessary to be regenerated? Because of this step right here. Right, in order for glycolysis to go in this direction, you need NAD plus. Right, NAD plus has to be reduced in order for glycolysis to take place because of the oxidation reduction reaction. Okay, well, when that pathway is working, how many ATPs are produced? When we go all the way from glucose to lactic acid, you only have glycolysis working. Glycolysis makes four, but two are used up, so that leaves two. This lactic acid pathway doesn't make any ATP whatsoever, so this anaerobic pathway just makes two ATP, but two ATP is better than nothing. Okay? All right. So, yields only two ATP. Red blood cells don't have mitochondria. As a matter of fact, they don't have much in the way of organelles at all. They don't even have a nucleus. So not mitochondria, red blood cells can make ATP only through glycolysis and using this lactic acid pathway. And that's kind of ironic. Why is that ironic? Because what's the oxygen concentration inside a red blood cell? It is high. That's why I think it's ironic. Right here you have a cell that's high in oxygen, but it operates anaerobically because it doesn't have the structure to take advantage of that oxygen. Namely, it doesn't have mitochondria. Right, so here you have this cell loaded with oxygen, but it doesn't operate, doesn't make ATP aerobically. That's why I think it's ironic. All right, so where does this take place? Skeletal muscle, heart muscle. When oxygen supply falls below a critical level, for instance, during heavy exercise, blood can't even get into these muscles, or when there's a blockage of a blood vessel. Hopefully it just doesn't close off completely, but you can get partial blockages, right? So you can get partial blockage of oxygen to these muscles, and that's when the lactic acid pathway will take over. All right, so here's, we got what? We got glycogen. Oh, here are a couple of other terms. All right, glycogenesis and glycogenolysis. What were the first two terms that we talked about? Glycolysis and gluconeogenesis. What, they're the reverse of each other? Okay. Glycogenesis is not the making of glucose, it's the making of glycogen. Right? The making of glycogen is glycogenesis, and the reverse process is glycogenolysis. What's olysis again? The breaking, the splitting up. What is it, the splitting up of? Glycogen. Okay. Well, you got to become familiar with these terms. If you look at these terms, glycolysis, gluconeogenesis, glycogenesis, and glycogenolysis, if you can't see the difference in these words, then before the next test, you need to get some good reading glasses. They seem very similar, right? But you just have to be able to know the difference between them, right, when you see them. Okay, so we're going to step back from glycolysis a little bit and just talk about glycogen. Well, we said that for osmotic reasons, the cell can't store many free glucoses. It can't store millions of molecules of glucose, because if it did, what would happen to water in the extracellular space? It would get sucked inside the cell, right? Because all those glucose particles inside the cell. To prevent that, what do you do with all those glucose particles? Those millions of particles you convert into just one, glycogen, right? And then all that water, right, will stay outside the cell like it should. All right, so skeletal muscle and liver can store lots of glycogen. And glycogenolysis is the reverse of glycogenesis. It just clips the glucose out of the glycogen molecule, and it's in the form of a phosphorylated glucose. And it's on the sixth carbon, so that's why we have a six over here. All right, glucose 6-phosphate. And a phosphate, is that a polar type molecule or a nonpolar type moiety? It's polar. What about polar compounds getting through the cell membrane? Do polar compounds go through a cell membrane? They do not, right? So when glucose gets phosphorylated with this polar compound, it cannot leave the cell. So when glucose is phosphorylated, it is trapped inside the cell because of that phosphate group. And that's the basis of this statement right here. That phosphorylation, the phosphate groups trap the glucose molecules inside cells. And muscles don't have a way to take that phosphate molecule off of glucose. So muscles will never give away glucose once they receive that glucose. But remember, on that previous slide, we saw, what did we see? We saw liver, okay, secreting glucose. It means that the liver has an enzyme that can take that phosphate off of glucose so that it can leave the liver. So liver is kind of like an altruistic organ. It will give away that energy to other organ systems in your body. All the other organ systems in your body, once they get glucose, will never share it with another organ, okay, because it's trapped in the form of that glucose 6-phosphate. Okay, so here are a couple terms. Glycolysis, what is that the conversion of? Glucose to pyruvic acid. And you should know a little bit more about that, like it produces some ATP. How many molecules of ATP? Two, but don't forget about those high energy electrons, right, in the form of NADH that are produced by glycolysis. Glycogenesis. Glycogenesis. What is this? Is this making glucose? No, it's making glycogen, right? So that's the production of glycogen from glucose. And think of two organs that do that, muscle and liver that do that. That's the organs that can store glycogen. And remember, glycogen is like starch. It's a polymer of glucose. Glycogenolysis is the reverse of glycogenesis, right? It's the hydrolysis. Are you familiar with a hydrolysis reaction? Yeah, you're very familiar with that. Right, so it's the breakdown of that big polymer of glycogen into its building blocks, which is glucose. Right, but it comes off in the form of this glucose 6-phosphate. And muscle doesn't have the glucose 6-phosphatase. Ooh, what does a phosphatase do? It takes off a phosphate, right? Muscle doesn't have the phosphatase, so that glucose is trapped inside the cell all the time. But liver has glucose 6-phosphatase, right, which can take the phosphate off, which then allows the liver to secrete glucose into the blood. And what happens to blood glucose levels then? They go up under conditions when blood glucose starts to decrease. Under what conditions does blood glucose start to decrease? You got two conditions. What are those two conditions? Fed or fasted. Okay, so when does glycogenolysis take place? Fed or fasted state? The fasted state, when blood glucose starts to go down, the liver is going to contribute its glucose to the rest of the body via this process called glycogenolysis. Okay, gluconeogenesis is making new glucose from other sources like lactic acid, maybe even some amino acids and some other kinds of other compounds, but not, oh, might want to put down here, not ever lipids. Gluconeogenesis can never be used, or lipids can never be used by gluconeogenesis. Okay, so once something is a lipid, can never be converted into anything else. Can't be converted into sugar. Sugar can be converted into lipid very easily, but the reverse is not possible. You'll probably see why in a couple hours. Lipogenesis. All right, well, we looked at these glucose and glycose pathways. What about lipogenesis? Yeah, that's the making of lipids, right? For instance, probably one that you're most familiar with would be triglycerides. And that happens in adipose tissue. So what are the building blocks for lipogenesis? Glycerol and three fatty acids, right? We'll make that triglyceride. Lipolysis. Oh, this is going to be good. Lipolysis is the breaking down of triglycerides into what? Okay, it happens in adipose tissue, right? But what are the building blocks of a triglyceride? Glycerol and three fatty acids, right? So lipolysis produces three fatty acids and glycerol. And one glycerol. Three fatty acids and one glycerol. All right, here is kind of a tricky statement. Lipolysis is not the breakdown of a fatty acid. Okay, the breakdown of a fatty acid will produce a lot of ATP for us, but lipolysis is not that. What is lipolysis? It's the breakdown of triglyceride into three fatty acids and a glycerol. If we want to get that energy out of those fatty acids, it has to go through another metabolic pathway, which we're going to talk about at the end of this particular lecture. Should I tell you what it is? Maybe right now? I don't know, maybe. It's called beta oxidation. Beta, the Greek letter beta, and then oxidation is the pathway that breaks down fatty acids, right, that produces ATP for us, right? Lipolysis doesn't break down fatty acids. Beta oxidation does. You have a couple questions at the end of the chapter and online, maybe even on the test or the online quiz. Ketogenesis. I'm not going to talk about that. That's too bad. We don't have really much time to talk about that. But it's the making of ketone bodies. I'll say just a little bit about that. Ketone bodies are produced when you break down lipids, like fatty acids, but you don't have sugars available to completely break them down into carbon dioxide. So your body will make things like acetone, fingernail polish remover, right? And what kind of liquid is acetone? If you pour a bunch on the table, does it sit there in a puddle for a long time? It evaporates very quickly. We say it's a very volatile substance, okay? So when we restrict sugars from our body, our bodies will produce these ketones, right? Through ketogenesis, acetone is one of these substances. And then as we breathe out carbon dioxide, what else do we breathe out of our body? Acetone, okay? And you can smell that on a person's breath. That is where their cells are starved from glucose. Maybe they're restricting it in their diet, or maybe glucose can't get into their cells. What condition does that person have when glucose can't enter their cells? It stays high in the blood because glucose can't leave the blood to get into cells. That is diabetes mellitus. That's right. So some diabetics, you can smell ketones on their breath. That's why their breath smells. It could be sweet, could be other kinds of things, right? So I said, when you restrict carbohydrates in your diet, your body then will try to metabolize fatty acids, and it can't metabolize all the way. It will produce ketone bodies, right? And the second circumstance was diabetes. So what is, when you restrict your carbohydrates in your diet, what is that like metabolically? You're starving the cells just like somebody that has diabetes mellitus does. Right, which is kind of interesting because people sometimes restrict carbohydrates from their diet severely, right, to lose weight, right? And it works really nice because what are you doing? You're taking fatty acids and you are just breathing them out of your body in the form of ketone bodies. It's marvelous. But what is that condition like? It's like diabetes, mellitus, right? And so your body isn't making a lot of ATP. Anybody know the name of a diet that was really the first, I think, along those lines? Atkins diet, right? And so when you're on an Atkins diet, you got to follow it very carefully because you're messing with that carbohydrate metabolism. You can severely restrict how much ATP your body is producing. So I certainly wouldn't recommend anybody on an Atkins diet when they're taking microbiology or physiology or chemistry class or anything like that, because your brain has to be functioning really well. As a matter of fact, if you're on an Atkins diet, I maybe would recommend that you don't even drive a car. Because somebody on an Atkins diet, if they're not really careful, they might see a red light and say, well, okay, what the heck. They just won't appreciate that it's a red light. You get really drive on the wrong side of the road. Right? We call that being dingy. Atkins diet, you can get really dingy because your body isn't making ATP because your body is acting more like a diabetic condition. Right? So you've got to be really careful with that. Okay, we got five more minutes. Do we have five more minutes in class?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Glycogenesis and glycogenolysis pathway. See, you guys didn't know chemistry was so much fun. It really is. Biochemistry is really a lot of fun. Okay. So here we have a cell, right? And it kind of looks red to me. So let's label some of these pathways. Glucose. And we're just going to call it, glucose 6-phosphate. Okay, going to be converted around through, and it's going to go into glycolysis, right? And when this glucose goes through glycolysis, what's being produced? ATP. Yeah, it's going to be, so glucose is being broken down into ATP, or producing ATP. Well, glucose 6-phosphate has some other fates. In this particular cell, if glucose is at a really high concentration, right, it could be stored. So what is number one? Right here is the arrow. Okay, glucose 1-phosphate being converted into glycogen. What pathway is number one right here? Glycogenesis. I even have to stop and think a second because I want to say it right the first time. Glycogenesis, so number one is glycogenesis. All right, and then, of course, if the cell is low on glucose, that glycogen can be used to rebuild this glucose. So glycogen going to glucose is called
glycogenolysis.
So number two is glycogenolysis. I don't know if there's a key in your textbook for these things. I know your figure has one and two. All right, and maybe it would be really nice to have glucose going to pyruvic acid. You would call that? Yeah, glucose going to pyruvic acid glycolysis, and you could maybe even draw a reverse arrow, pyruvic acid going to glucose, that is gluconeogenesis, new glucose. Wow, you guys are a lot of good information in this class. Okay, here I see glucose 6-phosphate, and a phosphate group is being taken off of it. And now that glucose can leave the cell because that inorganic phosphate group is a highly polar compound. When it's removed from glucose, it can be secreted from the cell. Do you know the name of this enzyme right here? It's named after the substrate, like a lot of enzymes are. It's called glucose 6-phosphatase. Remember, a phosphatase generally removes a phosphate group from something, right? And what it's removing it from is glucose. So glucose 6-phosphate gets converted to glucose. It can leave the cell via that enzyme called glucose 6-phosphatase. And only certain cells in your body have that enzyme. And that is the? Only the liver, right? So the liver can be used to maintain blood glucose levels, but not muscle, not any other kind of organ. All these other organs will never give up their glucose. All right, well, let's say, instead of liver, let's just say that this is a muscle cell. A muscle cell will take up glucose from the blood as long as there's a really good insulin signal, or maybe another thing, maybe this muscle is exercising, right? Exercising muscle, or when there's insulin, the cell can take up glucose. It enters the cell, and if it's a muscle cell, it's going to be greedy. It never wants to give that glucose away. What can it do to make sure? It's going to trap it inside the cell. How can it trap it? By adding a really polar compound to it, namely inorganic phosphate. Right, and it gets that inorganic phosphate from an ATP, right? So that ATP not only donates that phosphorus, that inorganic phosphate, but it also provides the energy for phosphorylation of glucose, right? So glucose to glucose 6-phosphate, what kind of enzyme is doing that? That is a kinase. Yeah, so jot that down here, right? So we call that glucokinase. Glucokinase traps glucose inside the cell because it phosphorylates. All right, and then once you have glucose 6-phosphate, what can you have? You can have glycogenesis, you can have glycolysis, and then after a time you can have like glycogenolysis or gluconeogenesis, depending on the energy status of this particular cell. So there's a lot on this slide right here. I think I've talked about everything that's on the text on the opposite side of this cell, but anybody see that I missed something over here? I don't think I missed anything. Okay. We're going to start next time with the Cori cycle. Here is that liver cell, which is kind of just a synopsis of what we looked at on this previous slide. And so next time we're going to look at Cori cycle, and I got to talk fast next time because we got to cover some other stuff. Okay, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, please.